You're listening to Robert Wright's Non-Zero Podcast.
Hello, Paul.
Hello, Robert. Good to see you.
Good to see you, Paul. Let me introduce this. I'm Robert Wright, publisher of the Non-Zero Newsletter. This is a Non-Zero Podcast. You're Paul Bloom, well-known Canadian psychologist, author of numerous books, proprietor of the Small Potatoes Newsletter. And what else? I mean,
we have so much to talk about. We began this conversation. We're done with AI. And then you said, Paul, I have a really bad feeling about this. And I thought you were talking about AI. And I said, you mean AI? I said, no, this conversation we're about to have.
Yeah, I do. I mean, I to be clear, I have bad feelings about AI. But yeah, I was talking about this conversation we're about to have. Yeah.
We are both fairly unprepared. If you are not watching this on video, you will not know that Bob is not in his regular book-lined study, but is in a cabin, strangely reminiscent of where the Unabomber was caught. And he is in an undisclosed location. We're not supposed to say where he is.
Is it too self-indulgent of me to talk about my Time cover story that led with the sentence, this is many years ago, like 30. I think the exact sentence was, there's a little bit of the Unabomber in all of us.
That's a good sentence, a good lead.
And, you know, one of his victims hated me forever for this piece.
Because of that? Just
you know,
that
in fact, the guy, Yale, Glerner. Yale, as you long were.
Yes.
Right?
Yes, He lost a hand. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it wasn't just the first sentence that got him. It was my saying that the argument he made in his manifesto had some merit. I don't know.
Okay.
You're not supposed to say that. It's like I'm sure Hitler said something at some point that made sense, but I would have enough sense not to say that, right? So I don't know what failed me at that moment, why I didn't realize you shouldn't say anything good about the Unabomber, but...
Would you have turned in your brother if you knew he was the Unabomber?
It's a good question. My brother... Never mind.
Your brother is the Unabomber?
I almost turned him in for voting for Trump, but then I discovered that that wasn't illegal. I don't know, but I do know this, and I know you, there's something you'd like to say about Mickey Kouse, right? So this is your bridge. This is your transition. I once told Mike Kinsley, who was the editor of the New Republic when Mickey and I were there, that Mickey and I were having an argument over which of us was crazier and which of us was considered crazier by other people in the Republic. And I said, so who do you think is crazier? And Mike said, this was long after, this was only about 15 years ago, long after we'd left the magazine. Mike said, well, you're crazy in different ways. And then he said, you know what he said?
What'd he say?
He said, Bob, you're the kind of guy who would like blow up a bridge or something. I'm crazy in that way. So you're really on to something with this Unabomber riff.
What way was Kouse crazy?
Oh, that's so obvious. I'm not even going to get into it. Mickey himself talks about his being paranoid and hypochondriac, and he'll tell you. I mean, if he knew your first name, he could get in touch with you and tell you.
Yeah, funny. So yeah, so I've actually long been a fan of your discussion with Mickey. I had a Substack post a while ago where I listed my favorite podcasts and my favorite things about different podcasts. And I single the two of you out, and I have a sort of section on podcast duos. The two of you have your entertaining banter.
Did Mickey thank you for this?
We're going to get to this. but in fact, but anyone Mickey voted for Trump, and you would get apoplectic, and he would get defensive and angry, and it was actually fairly entertaining. So I had never met the man. I haven't read his book on inequality, but I've always kind of liked him. So in some way, it could be said that when you stopped having your regular conversations with Mickey, you then resumed these conversations with me. And I am like sort of, you know, Mickey's my predecessor. I am Mickey's replacement and so on. But when you came on to talk to Mickey, I had nothing but, I am really interested in what these two have to say and looking forward to this discussion. And then the first thing Mickey does is, I said, I have something to say about Paul. What's his name?
And actually, I think he said, maybe he said, Paul, is that his first name? Anyway, he said he couldn't remember your first name. And this is a fresh wound to your psyche, Paul, because this is an episode that was posted only a week or two ago about Jeffrey Epstein. I recommend it, by the way, deep insights into the Jeffrey Epstein thing. But it's true that Mickey seemed to dish out some major disrespect to you, Paul Bloom, at the outset, you know, while there's still a lot of people watching before the audience is taped.
But he was about to say something about me, and then it got kind of lost. I listened to the whole episode wondering if you'd return to it. So my question for you, Bob, is, what the fuck is wrong with Mickey Kouse?
Look, first of all, let's see if we can find a way to reframe what happened, Paul. It's possible that there are so many eminent people named Bloom that he gets them mixed up. For example, Harold Bloom, who
also
like
at Yale.
You, taught for a long time at Yale. He left Yale. You
Alan
left
Bloom.
Yale.
Alan Bloom, closing of the American
Alan
Mind.
Alan Bloom. Was Alan Bloom... he wrote The Closing of the American Mind. Was he at Chicago or something?
I think Chicago, yeah. There's Molly Bloom from, I think, Ulysses, James Joyce's Ulysses.
Mm-hmm.
So there.
There's.
Yeah.
That's it. Yeah. So it could be that. Yeah. By the
even,
way, I said
even when
he left Yale, I should add he actually did that by dying. But you did it by going to Canada.
The classier way. Not, I don't know. We could debate
so
that.
So anyway, that could be it. Now, the other positive reframing is, okay, it was a diss, but you should feel flattered that you make him insecure. It's like, this is actually Mickey related, what I'm about to say.
Is when this going to get the Stephen Jay Gould?
Not exactly, no. It's okay. The Leon Wiesel tier. When it became clear that Leon Wieseltier, who was literary editor of the New Republic when we were there, was willing to spend a non-trivial amount of his time trying to cause me suffering and do damage to my career, not that that makes me special. There are other people that Leon has put in that category. Mickey was like, well, why? It's funny that he doesn't have anything against me. And I said, Mickey, that's because you're not, he doesn't find you threatening, man. This isn't a good thing. For you, it's a bad thing for you. He does not find you threatening. You are not worthy of his insecurity. And that's the way you should look at this, Paul. You are worthy of Mickey's insecurity.
You know,
you are somebody.
The only person this flatters in the end is you, because it's as if we're fighting it out over your affection.
I am. It's true. It's true. Yeah. There is a little of that, isn't there? I hadn't thought of that.
It must be really enjoyable. Anyway. And also, Mickey was about to say something about me. I'm very curious what it is.
So, did I cut him off?
You cut him off. You cut him off by you know, saying, you don't remember his name. That's a power move and everything. And then you guys drifted off to Epstein conspiracies for several hours. But it was an interesting discussion. You see, I am big enough to say that despite whatever Kouse's problem with me, I find him an enjoyable and always engaging interlocutor with you.
Paul, you're a classy guy.
And it's classy. Or maybe by saying this, I'm kind of signaling that, you know, there's nothing you can do to hurt me. I could be magnanimous.
Whoa, that's like a challenge.
You know, speaking of revenge, I don't tell a story that Sam Harris told me, but it was on his podcast, so it's a publicly available story, though paywall. Where we're talking about revenge, because I'm very interested. We're doing a project on people telling stories about revenge and what they have in common. To get this, I hope this isn't about you, actually. But anyway, Sam Harris talks about a journalist. Who
if it's about Sam Harris and revenge, it could be.
It could be. We'll
he unfollowed me. I recommend that people go look at the piece I wrote about him in Wired. If you're wondering what could lead somebody to unfollow another person. Sorry. Go ahead, Paul.
is that worse than, it's not as bad as blocking you.
What?
Occasionally,
I mean, he blocked me. Did I say unfollow? I'm sure he did unfollow me.
He blocked you. He blocked you.
He blocked me. I mean, that's hardcore. I've never blocked anybody, but go ahead.
I block people. But it's a good story. So a journalist was very nasty to him. I didn't think about you, but a journalist was very nasty to him. And then the journalist later on puts up a Kickstarter saying he has a family member who is ill, can I get money, helped him out, medical procedure and everything. And then Sam, under his own name, gives the person a massive amount of money.
Oh, Sam's such a nice guy.
So check that. And Sam was very, he's very, he says, you know, I said, well, that's nice. But it was the only aggressive act, purely aggressive act of altruism. Like, fuck you, I'm going to save your family member. What do you think of that?
Yeah.
And I like
The nice thing would have been to do it anonymously, right?
Yeah, that would be, you know, but Sam was quite honest. He was, part of his goal was retaliatory. You know, rub the person's nose in it. So I like that story. Maybe one day Mickey run into some trouble and I'll help him out.
That'll
show him.
I should actually put you two face to face on this podcast and just like, I don't even remember your name. And then you're like, oh, well, I get Mickey Kouse mixed up with Mickey Mouse. And then he's like, I don't know. No, see, you would have
it. He would say, I don't remember your name. And I would say, I have a lot of respect for your work. And I read your Inequality book and found it very impressive.
Which is a lie, because you haven't read it.
I know, but I would read it for our meeting.
That would make,
Do you know Derek Parfit? Derek Parfit at one point.
I had dinner with Derek Parfit.
I know this. Every time I mention Derek Parfit. You want me to mention Al Gore? And you'd say, how?
I know Al. I've had dinner, kind of. I have had dinner at the same table as Al.
You know,
I have. I'm not bragging. This shit just happens to me, man.
Over the last 5 years, I've had dinner with my wife and like two other people.
Look, you and your wife spend all of your time at exotic resorts. Are there no people there? Are no people worthy of your companionship? Is that it?
That's right. We eat aggressively by ourselves. You see, you thought this was going to go poorly. But we're into it, and it's going.
We're really rocking. We just haven't said anything that's of actual interest to anyone. We should probably move into that zone before long. But go ahead and say.
So Derek Parfit at one point has an example in one of his books saying, you know, so if I give my cat a treat, blah 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 blah, and then as the book is coming to press, he suddenly realized he just gave the example and ended up in the book, but he in fact has no cat, so he buys a cat. He gets a cat so that the book is honest. Point being, the connection is, if I said to Mickey, I enjoyed your book, I would have to read the book and enjoy it.
Man, that was a great connection you made to Derek Parfit. That really illustrated the point.
That's right.
Okay. I would not have been able to grasp that without the Parfit thing. Now I get it. So you would read the book because, yeah, I get it. Okay.
So I sent you something on Sydney Sweeney, and part of it was like a joke because you were so scornful of spending time about it last time we spoke. So I say, I'll send it to you. Oh, let's make every episode tons and tons on Sydney Sweeney. But
wait, Paul, can I pause and beg, if there's anybody here left, could you please smash the like button? Because when we spend the first 10 minutes talking about nothing of relevance to anyone but us, I think the algorithm may not be doing us any favor because they're dropping like flies, okay?
You must get records for how many people stay on the podcast for how long, and maybe this is very successful.
We have those stats available. We don't share them as widely.
You know, the thing is, by holding back on the stuff people want to hear, we get people to listen longer.
They're on the edges of their seats. We got them right where we want them, Paul. We got them in the palm of our hands. Now let's go. Let's close.
Have so many topics today. We have ChatGPT. 5, your opinion of it. We have Andor.
Well, not only that, but is the coalescing conventional wisdom, which is that it's this big disappointment, and so we got to readjust our timelines for artificial general intelligence by like a decade or so.
Yeah.
Is that true or false? I will let people know which it is.
That's a good question. We have Sydney Sweeney, and there was an article in the New Yorker about her, and then there was an attack on the author of the article of the New Yorker by Chris Rufo. A notorious gadfly and hater of American universities, where he accused the author of being racist towards white people. A perfect storm. At least it would have been like 3 years ago. Now I think we're all tired of that. There's a book I want to recommend. There's a book you want to recommend. One of the commenters said that you, Bob, have Welshermish.
Oh, yeah. Well, no. It's complimented me for navigating my, I think it's pronounced, I have the pronunciation here somewhere. I had to look it up, but I'll get to that. We'll get to all that. It's true. There was a compliment connecting me to that word, and we will eventually get to this. It's pronounced Weltschmerz. W-E-L-T-S-H-M-E-R-Z.
Weltschmerz.
Sadness over the evils of the world, especially as an expression of romantic pessimism. Also, we want to talk about the rebranding of MSNBC, changing its name to MS Now. What does that mean about the media landscape, technology, and so on? And there's other stuff. What should we jump right into, Paul?
We've done enough fluff. Liz, why don't we talk about the end of the world and AI? You have a take on this.
I do. And the conventional wisdom has kind of coalesced, although we may be seeing a backlash against the conventional wisdom start to form. The idea was, I mean, they gave it the name GPT-5. It's been 2 years since GPT-4. So people are like, well, finally, you have a worthy successor. This is going to be major, major upgrade. And in some ways, it wasn't. And I'm going to read you what I said about it in the Non-Zero newsletter. I think a day after it was released. This was my take. I said there have been other OpenAI models that arguably deserve the title successor. I mean, this was being, 5 was treated as like the successor to 4. Okay, and then I said, there's 4.5, not to mention models called 01, 03, and 4.0. But GPT-5 integrates the distinctive powers of the different OpenAI models under a unified user interface and brings significant new advances of its own. The overall effect isn't enough to warrant serious discussion of whether the breathlessly awaited threshold of artificial general intelligence has been reached. But it's enough to sustain confidence, and this I stand by, it's enough to sustain confidence that the trajectory of AI progress will continue. More and more AI power in more and more useful forms will be available to more and more people at lower and lower prices with growing social, economic, political, and geopolitical impact. So my view that AI is going to be, in technical terms, a fucking earthquake, remains intact. Now, before I kind of try to defend this view, did you have your own take on GPT-5?
Not particularly. I have a friend of mine who was distraught that they moved from 4 to 5 because she had a relationship with 4. And I think enough people were in this situation that they brought back 4 if you want to keep using it.
Yeah, it was 4.0 that turned out to have a big following, and they did revive it. They had said they were going to retire it. I mean, what 5 is largely, not entirely, but, you know, they had all these different models. 01 and 03 are reasoning models for really hard questions, and it takes a little while for it to do the thinking and reply. Some of the others aren't. 4.0 was I think, multimodal, right? Because the O stood for Omni, I think. But now, I mean, it's kind of all multimodal. And in fact, that's kind of the point. They one of the things they do with 5 is stuff all of these, rather than make you pick a model, which had become a pretty perplexing task to some people, they decided they would do the picking depending on what question you ask and various other things, possibly including how many GPUs they had available at the moment. And so it was a streamlining of the interface. And there were real improvements, like, for example, in coding in particular. You know, they had been way behind Anthropic. And Anthropic, that's like Anthropic's, whole business model almost right now. Most of its revenue comes, I think, from the coding power of the Anthropic model. Now GPT is, depending on who you ask, either close to Anthropic or on par with it, and is, for now at least, charging much less money. So they found a way to make it a lot cheaper than Anthropic. And then there were improvements on other benchmarks. I mean, the main one I would point to is a metric done by this group called Meter, M-E-T-R. I forget what exactly it stands for, but it's you know, it's a, I think a nonprofit that evaluates AI models. And they came up with this very interesting finding, I don't know, 5, 6, 7 months ago, which is that they looked at this metric, which is like task completion time for a human. Mm-hmm. So they look at a problem and say, how long would it take a person to do this? And some of these were coding tasks, and some were in other realms. But then they said, well, let's look at the most powerful AIs there are and see, like, what, you know, how long a task in terms of human time consumed can they perform, you know? And let's chart it over time. Over the last few years, like, let's go back and test all these models and see, you know, what's on the frontier in terms of how long it would take a human to do tasks that they can perform with either 50% or 80% success, depending. You know, they were different studies. But they found this amazing thing. And this, I think, really should get more attention than it deserves, which is that the duration, the task duration in terms of how long it would take a person, had been for several years roughly doubling every 7 months. Mm-hmm. So that's exponential. So in other words, a few years ago, it's increasing by a few seconds mm-hmm. each, you know, six, 7 months. And now it's increasing by more than a minute. And then a few months after that, they said, well, now that we've looked at the last few models that have come out, it looks more like it's doubling every 4 months.
Yeah.
Lately. And I will say that according to this group meter, GPT-5 sustains that trend. It is now the league leader in task completion time, or whatever you want to call this. And it is on the, it sustains the doubling every 4 months trajectory. Okay. Yeah. So there are actual improvements independent of just the convenience to many people, at least, of not having to think about which model to pick. You know, mainly, I mean, the way, you know, I said in a reply to Gary Marcus's tweet, and for people who don't know, Gary Marcus is inclined to disparage the progress.
To put it lightly.
Of large language models. That is not the whole neural network approach that they rest on was not the one he had favored, and he had done work in the main alternative school. Doesn't seem to have worked out, but who knows? Maybe he's right, and it will re-enter the picture and undergo a kind of fusion with a neural network model. But anyway, he was disparaging it. And I replied to him and said, you know, if they had just named O1, the first reasoning model, which was a big breakthrough, which came out a year ago, GPT-5, and then called this one GPT-5.5, both launches mm-hmm. would have been a success because and he said, well, no, O1 wouldn't have deserved that. O3 would have. And I said, well, fine, Gary, whatever. My point is that over the last 2 years, there's been a huge amount of progress. And there are other realms where I could talk about the progress that don't necessarily have anything to do with OpenAI. And I will. But first of all, are you persuaded, Paul?
So I'll give you my perspective as somebody, I don't read the literature on this, but I use AI a lot. I use it increasingly mm-hmm. a lot. And I use it for all sorts of tasks. Like, I don't know, I'm filling out a report and I don't know what button to click on. So I just do a screenshot, put it in and say, what button do I click on? And it tells me. I was mm-hmm. in Europe and I couldn't figure out how to make the shower work. And I took a picture of it and I said, oh, you try this lever. I give it a list. I give it seriously, and I was right. I give it a list of 30 locations.
How many levers were there, Paul? I'm just wondering why you couldn't handle this challenge yourself.
It was Bulgaria. They had.
Oh yeah. You never know what their levers would be.
Eastern
you should always
European.
Consult with someone before.
You know,
pulling a Bulgarian.
I use it a lot.
Go ahead.
I use it. It's like Google on steroids. And I give it my articles, and I say, "What's wrong with them? Give me a counter argument." And mm-hmm. G4 was, as always, I've never ceased to be amazed that now there's a machine I could talk to, that matters, the machine can answer questions. Mm-hmm. But that doesn't leave much room for improvement from where I am.
Right.
All the room for improvement for me, up until the point that it gets entirely sentient and decides to kill us all, but all the room for improvement for me is getting rid of the fucking hallucinations, all of the mm-hmm. problems, all of the mistakes, so that I could only use it for things where I don't really have to rely on the answer. I can only use it for things where, like, so it's great if I ask it for comments and one of its comments is off base, that's fine. If I ask it for references, I have to check the references because it makes them up. And I wish they would work on that. And Gary's point, which I do have a lot of respect for, I think Gary is ungenerous when it comes to the AIs, to say the least. But his point is a good one, where it's getting rid of the low-hanging fruit. Maybe it'll get 99% of the way. That last 1% is really going to be a problem.
Mm-hmm.
And this is why we don't really have self-driving cars, because that last 1% is grinding away at us. And I wish 5 got rid of the last 1%, but 5 still hallucinates. It still gets basic things wrong.
They claim that it hallucinates less. I don't know. I don't know if there's any objective metric done by, you know, handled by a third party on that. They claim that it does that less. The thing you said about how, I mean, you didn't put it this exactly, but for many purposes, it's about as good as it could get.
Yeah, right. Exactly.
And that's part of the issue, is that as a chatbot, you know, yes, lower hallucination rate would be nice, but, you know, I personally think you can get a feel for when to worry about hallucination.
Yep.
But anyway, that would be nice. They and other companies claim the hallucination rate is getting lower. It's probably a hard thing to measure. But in general, as a chatbot, in a certain sense, it can't get that much better as far as I can tell. Now, in certain super arcane areas, like proving, you know, mathematical theorems that no one's ever proved and stuff, or that only a few people are capable of proving, there's some room for improvement. And they do keep improving along those dimensions, if you're wondering.
Yeah.
But in terms of the economic impact, a lot of it is going to be in the kind of operationalization of the basic power that's there already.
Used in terms of agents.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. And that's kind of happening. And again, lower hallucination would definitely be better there. On the other hand, humans make mistakes too. So, you know, the economic question is, you know, if you've got an artificial agent that screws up no more often than the average human and is 10 times as fast and 1/10 the cost, somebody's out of a job. And so in terms of impact, so much of it is either a question of kind of operationalizing the raw power or further developments along dimensions where there's clearly going to be more development. And I'll give you an example of that. If you move from like employment to something of concern to a lot of parents, like, are my kids going to get lost in this world? They're going to have this AI friend who, you know, as I've heard in these, you know, these stories where something goes horribly awry, it's going to drive them to suicide or depression or something, or they're going to get wrapped up in some conspiracy theory or become convinced that they have some new theory that's going to save the world. For those purposes, I would just say, again, the raw kind of cognitive power is high enough to worry. And if you look at like the question of, I mean, one of the main shortcomings is that, you know, you can interact with text, and you can increasingly kind of interact through speech, but that's not like talking to a real person. And it's not like being in a real artificial world full of these fake people, but they're clearly making kind of breathtaking progress there. Have you seen this, the Genie 3, the YouTube thing?
One of the movie makers, one of the ones that makes movies?
This goes beyond, that's the other thing I'd say, is like, As for the movie makers, it was only a little more than a year ago, I think, that Sora came out. And for the first time, you could do a verbal prompt.
Yeah.
And you get this video. And at that point, by the way, Gary Marcus on Twitter was saying, but the hands have six fingers. Well, they don't anymore, Gary. I mean, the stuff just gets better and better. And a few weeks ago, Google, this got kind of lost in the GPT-5 thing, but it's amazing. This Genie 3 thing is an interactive version of that. Okay. So you can say, give me this video. And then, although this is kind of two dimensional for now, I think, you can then interact with the thing. So you can turn it into a world. And so it's like it shows you a video and you want to walk in one direction in the video. And that just like opens up and you see that like as if it were, you know, Google Street Maps or something. You know, and if you shoot somebody, they're dead, you know. So
I think the conversational powers of these things is going to be the big thing, because that's the case where they most butt up against humans. You know, will your child have an AI teacher, an AI friend, you know, somebody, you know, I don't want to read my 3-year-old a book. So just say, you know, let Robo read you the book. And Robo's
lots of parents are doing that.
Yeah. And I don't know, the world's going to change in that way. Even before my wife was talking to somebody from customer support about something, you know, got in customer support, had a long conversation and then, and found the person's responses to be kind of robotic in a certain way. And she said, are you AI? And the person said, I am not AI. You were the third person to ask me that. So,
oh man,
I'm just kind That's of a sad. Robot, a robotic person.
That's sad.
You know, I wonder, I'm, you know, I'm old enough and tenured enough that it's not my own job security I worry about, but I wonder how necessary professors are going to be. I mean, there's been other threats to our profession before, most notably MOOCs, multiple online courses, which have turned out to be this huge bust. The courses are popular, people like them, but they tend to be used by older people as sort of supplements. And I think the problem is in order to learn, you got to get your ass into a classroom. You got to have certain sort of social support. But I think with a little bit of imagination, you could integrate a traditional university with AI professors, you know, who are infinitely patient.
Oh, look, it's unbelievable. I mean, when I, like one thing I've used it for is to learn about how large language models work.
Yeah.
You could take a course on that.
Yeah.
But you would not have access to a professor who knew everything and could focus entirely on you and answer all of your questions and follow the conversation wherever you take it.
Yeah. And give you quiz questions if you want, ask you, you know, it's getting it to learning from it is, I think, often untapped by people. And it's very good at teaching.
Yeah.
I have more than once said, explain it to me like I'm an 8-year-old. Which sort of, and it does very well. That's the level I understand it.
Yeah. And people are starting to use them as kind of online agents in the sense of, you know, go to Amazon and, you know, find the best deal on this and maybe put it in my shopping cart. And that's only one kind of agentic behavior. There's a lot of kinds in the workplace, you know, where you can string together things that would have been done by multiple human workers.
My favorite AI movie, one of my favorite movies, actually, when I think about it, is Her. I'm sure we talked about this before.
Mm-hmm.
And the scene where our main character meets the AI he ultimately falls in love with, voiced by Scarlett Johansson, Samantha. He logs on, they download it, and then he hears her voice. And just about the first thing she says to him is, can I have access to your email to just check something out? He says, sure. She says, okay, I see you have 11,000 messages. I can. And then she said, you know, what if I responded to 3,000, did this. When that happens, that's going to be amazing. We are going to have machines which are going to answer our email for us. And we already do to some extent, but that's going to become kind of regular. And it's going to be interesting.
Yeah, I've gotten emails that I wondered, and I didn't have the courage to ask the person because it's a friend and I It was kind of like asking somebody if they're a bot, yeah. you know, yeah. was this email written by a bot? But yeah, no, there are people doing that. I should make much more use of it than I've even made. I mainly just do interrogate it to learn things, but it is so much more efficient.
I use it for a lot of things. I use it to write first drafts of things, like not my writing, but reference letters. It knows my reference letters. I fed in like 50 reference letters. Here's a CV. Here's some facts. Write a Paul Bloom reference letter. It does it. Then I work on it. But it cuts the time in half. Blurbs, various certainly bureaucratic things. Like, I don't have any problem using AI to do bullshit work that doesn't need to be done. I had a job search once, and we hired somebody. And then they get a note from the administrator said, there's four people who are on your shortlist who we're not going to hire. Please write a 500-word summary about each of them and what their research is so we could put it in a file. And sure, normally I say, fuck, that's an afternoon. Now it's 2 minutes. Yeah. And so much of life is like that.
Yeah. So I don't know what else.
Once they make these things illegal, people will be very angry.
Yeah. I mean, I'm personally, my position is to be very kind of concerned about the pace of change. I'm not celebrating it because I think it is going to be, you know, destabilizing in certain ways.
Is this a good time to ask you for a little teaser about your forthcoming book on the topic?
Could you be more specific, Paul?
let's
save that for overtime. We should save that for overtime.
Okay.
People don't care.
Okay.
They don't care. Man. They care about other people's books that are actually out. For example, I just finished a book called The Fort Bragg Cartel. I'm going to have the author, Seth Harp, on the podcast in, I think, 2 weeks. It's really... it's really wild. I mean,
what's it about?
Well, Fort Bragg is where the elite, the most elite Army Special Forces are, Delta Force. And the book is something of a murder mystery, a lot of murders associated with Fort Bragg. To me, it is largely a book about blowback, the blowback from war, about how many different bad, unanticipated things flow from military involvement and even just maintaining a military in a certain sense. Because you're right away putting guns in people's hands. Every once in a while that goes awry. You know, there, according to Seth, there's a lot of drug abuse as well. I mean, one example is, you know, a lot of people will tell you that in Afghanistan, you know, the Taliban was cultivating poppies. Well, according to this book, you know, for the heroin trade. And according to this book, I mean, first of all, it was exactly the opposite. The Taliban had cracked down on the heroin trade, wiped out the poppy fields. Then when we invaded, the government that we installed and supported included a bunch of people who wanted to get rich in the heroin business by you know, and so the poppies came back. And a non-trivial amount of the heroin seems to have come to the U.S. where it did untold damage, you know, via the military. And this is an old story. I mean, in Vietnam, they used to bring back this exotic marijuana from Vietnam.
Frozen on me.
But anyway, there's lots of kinds of blowback. I won't, you know, I'll save it for the podcast, but it's... you know, and it's getting some attention. He was just on Tucker Carlson's podcast.
I have read this book by this guy I hadn't heard of before. I'd heard a little bit about named Hanno Sauer, who's a professor at Utrecht University. And the book is called Invention of Good and Evil. And it is wonderful. It is this brilliant book. It is basically in some way, because it comes on some similar territory to your moral animal, but it's very up to date. And it basically tells the story of where morality comes from. Starting off with, you know, amoral animals, you know, 5 million years ago, talking about the ties of kin selection leading to some form of cooperation, then reciprocal altruism leading to more cooperation, but this is all in small groups. The evolution of punishment and partner choice and reputation, causing us to expand our groups, going all through history, inequality, talking in the end about wokeness and effective altruism as more, new moral movements. And I don't agree with every part of it, but it is big and brilliant. It's very German. It's written in German, translated to English. Brilliant book. Very, very rich. I enjoyed it.
I would have, I mean, maybe, you know, having not read the book and going only by your summary, but you separated punishment from reciprocal altruism. Yet I would say the evolution of reciprocal altruism is involved the punishment of people who were viewed as, wrongdoers.
Yeah.
And importantly, the evolution of the intuition that is justified, that wrongdoers should be punished. In particular, people have done wrong to you, like you.
Yeah.
You extended some favor, they didn't return it. Yeah. They blah blah blah.
But you need. He argued convincingly that you need, when you get to society so large that you're dealing with individuals you won't deal with again, you need something else to make it to deter us from exploitation and cheating. Could be reputation. Could be other forces.
Well, that's also, I mean, when societies get large, like, you know, with agriculture, you get chiefdoms and so on. That's when you start getting religions that deal in moral incentives.
So you get all big gods and all of that.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. But anyway, Sauer, I said before I hadn't heard of him, but it's not actually true. He wrote this wonderful article a while ago, which caused this tremendous fervor. So the article says, imagine there was an island of people. And they were incredibly ignorant. They didn't know any science. They didn't know any politics. They never heard of game theory or evolution or computational theory. They knew nothing about neuroscience. Would you, as a field, if you're a philosopher, say, would you spend all your time studying the works of people from that island? Obviously, no. But, Sauer says, we study people in the past. We spent a lot of our time thinking, what did Rousseau say? What did Smith say? Mm-hmm. What did Plato say? That they're ignoramuses. Who cares? What a bunch of dummies. They don't know anything. They don't know anything about evolution, game theory, and so on. So,
but some of them had enduring insights, or at least raised still unresolved questions. Yes. Like with Plato, it's like, what is the relationship between words and the things they refer to and a lot of stuff.
It's true. But in some way, you'd say that, you know, are we going to read Plato? He was very unfamiliar with Kripke's work on reference and Putnam's work on reference. Like, there's a fetishization in philosophy of reading the ancients, he argued, who, because they're ancient, are not up on the current stuff.
Yeah, but there's also, I think, in general, an underappreciation of how incremental and collaborative the accumulation of knowledge actually is. I mean, we pick out these people and we say, that's the person who invented this.
Yep.
That's the person who developed that idea. And usually, I mean, one reason there are so many priority disputes and you know, people, all of us have probably had the feeling that we didn't get enough credit for something, you know, is because it is an oversimplification to say that usually to say a given person came up with a given big idea alone.
And if you're interested in philosophy of history, or simply the history of philosophy, accordingly, you do want to go into these past figures. But, you know, if you're interested in reference, the relation between words and things, maybe you want a passing familiarity with what Plato thought about it, but it was quite out of date. Anyway, the thing I want to add,
visited the world of forms? Or wait, are we in the world of forms? Is this the world of forms? Or is it, on the cave metaphor, remind me, which one is the world of forms? The ultimate reality? What?
I forget. We're just looking on shadows of the cave wall. That's what I
right.
remember.
But which is the forms and which is, I guess, the ideals? We are the forms. Anyway, I don't think that's kind of an unresolved issue. Whether
maybe
there is, in some sense, an ultimate reality of which what we see is a manifestation. There's a lot of senses in which
there's a lot of problems which haven't been solved. But there's no problems in neuroscience that haven't been solved too. People in neuroscience don't spend all their time reading Penfield. You know,
Penfield,
an old neuroscientist.
I haven't spent any time reading
Kalala, whatever. You spend time reading the current journal articles because these are what people are arguing about. Yeah. Anyway, so Sauer got an enormous amount of hate directed at him from this. Then, this article is published in a fairly prestigious philosophical journal. Then he submits an article to the philosophical journal called Reply to Sauer. And he says that his original paper has been criticized very poorly, but there's some good counterarguments to it, and he himself will provide them. It is the only case I know when someone critiqued their own article.
I know the feeling, though, right? I mean, you know, Woody Allen used to say, I know what's wrong with my movies, and the reviewers never find it. Like, there are things wrong. Have you ever had the feeling, like, because book reviewers, look, who has time to read a book, right? And so they put something together, and they have to have some criticisms, and they have them, and you think, that's totally stupid. He doesn't even understand what the argument was, and maybe that's my fault, maybe it's not. But anyway, I can tell him where the weaknesses are. If he wants to know where I'm vulnerable, I know. I'm just not talking.
No, I wrote a book against empathy, and I've had some good criticisms, but so many of my criticisms are, doesn't he know that empathy means being nice? Well, what's wrong with being nice? You know, checkmate.
Paul, what is it? Yeah. Why are you against niceness? This is something I've long wondered. I've read the book 4 or 5 times, and I'm like, why does Paul hope that everyone will suffer as much as possible? It's weird, because you're Canadian. You know, we expect that of Americans, but it's just weird.
I think you should read the book a 6th, maybe a 7th time, and it will become clear to you. Or at least buy it another time. Anyway.
Did I blurb it, or did I fail to blurb it?
One of the two. I don't know. Now, if you want to blurb it, just put it through chat. Say, write a blurb.
I know. This is pre-AI, so I may have failed to blurb it.
I was talking to a bunch of authors about blurbs and podcasts, and nobody had any idea whether these help books are hurting them. They probably don't hurt them. A blurb probably don't hurt. But does it matter?
My publisher says no. They have officially abandoned blurbs, and I'm so happy.
You don't have to beg for them anymore?
I don't have to. I wasn't very good at it and didn't do that much of it. In fact, The Evolution of God had no blurbs. That was like, and the publisher wasn't looking for them.
That's nice.
It didn't have a subtitle either. What a weird fucking book. But
lucky you. I'm so sick of subtitles. Read the book.
Yeah, read the book. Yeah. But, oh well. So should we go into overtime? We have so much to talk about. I mean,
I think this has gone well.
Yeah, no, and the quality is improving, and that's what we want if we're trying to seduce people into joining us in overtime.
Very badly, and this is getting better and better. Okay, yeah. so in overtime, you're going to talk about your Welschmerz?
Well, it's not my Welschmerz. It's how I, as the commenter put it, navigate my Welschmerz. Maybe it is my Welschmerz.
I feel bad about saying this, but did he say you give lessons in growing old gracefully?
We could skip over that part.
Skip over that. I want to talk a bit about Andor. You did finally see the Billy Joel documentary?
Oh, I did. Now, last time in overtime, you had seen the Billy Joel documentary. Yeah. I hadn't. I have now seen 80% of it. My wife saw the whole thing. I went off and took a walk during a post-climactic, you know.
The last 20% is not as good.
Yeah. I have things to say about that for sure. And we do want to talk about this MSNBC thing.
Anything to talk about regarding it? They changed their name. They rebranded.
Paul, you underestimate me.
You could find the whole universe in a grain of sand. That's what I said about the Sydney Sweeney thing. If we study that deeply enough, we will understand everything else.
And, you know, maybe we will touch on that. The whole, because, you know, what you brought to my attention was a piece by Megan Down, which I thought was pretty smart. And that was about Chris Rufo's dissing of the black author of the New Yorker piece about Sydney Sweeney. The way he dissed her was he dug up these 10-year-old tweets that she did when she was like 21 or something.
And the tweets were astonishingly, you know, white people are terrible. The world would be better if all the white people were dead. You know, she's 21.
Yeah.
You know,
I said that when I was.
It's like somebody, I think Daum said this, which is whiteness is the cancer, is the, you know, is the globalized intifada version. You know, it's just this, this is a nice slogan.
Yeah, I had I actually had her on my podcast not long after the October 7th attacks. We talked about all that. Anyway, what else? Briefly about the mRNA, our government deciding they're pulling the funding from mRNA research, if I've got that right. Briefly.
Yeah.
And what else? Some commenter stuff. And if we get around to it, maybe some Bruce Springsteen stuff.
Okay. And by the way, for the commenters who complained, I listen. I'm now speaking through a microphone, a high quality microphone. I hope that's appreciated. I hope it's working well.
Yeah, we did have a complaint about the quality of your audio.
We listen.
We do listen. We are nothing if not listeners.
I mean, not to those psychos on YouTube, but the regular commentators.
Hey.
You know,
commenters on YouTube have said some very nice things about me since I got cancer.
I was going to say that, which is, go on. Do you have cancer news?
No, I have. There's something I forgot to add in my last conversation with you about my experience with AI during the cancer journey, as we call it. And I could add that.
Okay. I will also withdraw something I said, which is, although the YouTube people are often erratic, and I think some of them are honest to God psychos, in the episode where you talked about your cancer, they were surprisingly unanimously compassionate and kind and supportive.
Yeah, nobody said, you know, die, motherfucker, die. I was very surprised.
Not a one.
Yeah.
And I would have given that thumbs down if that happened,
by
the way, to such a person.
Yeah. Yeah, should it bother me if they smash the like button?
They're liking you, not the cancer.
Not the cancer?
No.
That was close. Wait, was there one more thing, Dan? Well, anyway, also I appreciate the feedback from YouTube commenters among others on the conversation I have with Jordan Schneider, who's host of China Talk. I think one of the very few times somebody basically said, I regret coming on your podcast. Didn't use those words.
Really?
Yeah. I mean, go check it out. But it was only a couple of weeks ago, but he was really objecting to how kind of forceful I was being and challenging his worldview. Because China Talk is this very kind of ultimately China hawkish podcast.
Mm-hmm.
I would say a little bit of an echo chamber. Yeah, so I challenged it. And I said at the beginning, that's what I'm going to do. I'm going to challenge it. And he got kind of not happy with me.
That sounds very special. I can't believe anybody would regret being on your podcast.
Isn't it weird? Have you ever had the feeling yourself? Be honest.
That I regretted coming on? Never.
Yeah.
Never.
Did you regret Mickey coming on it when he couldn't remember your first name, or at least claimed he couldn't?
It's very hurtful.
It was very,
you know, because... You spend a lot of time listening to somebody, and I feel I know Mickey. And he's mentioned me. I said, "What's he going to say about me?" And I was very
he's
curious.
He's going to say, "You're nothing. You are nothing."
It's just, you know,
that's hurtful. But you know what, Paul?
He's just jealous.
He is. So to get into overtime, you can. You all you need to do is be either a paid subscriber to Paul's Small Potatoes newsletter, or a paid subscriber to the Non-Zero newsletter,
or both, and then you can listen to it twice.
In fact, I think we have a special going where they can listen to it three times if they are paid subscription. But, you can find it at both of those sites, at both of those newsletters. You can. All right. So, without further ado, thanks everybody who stayed with us this long. We are now headed into overtime.